question and answer session, which is my favorite, but it's also exhausting. So I have mixed feelings about it, but I really like it. Now, before we start, there's something you should understand about question and answer. You're going to hear an answer. You're not hearing the answer, okay? And answers aren't based necessarily on anything that was learned. It isn't a learning process. This is simply how things look to me now. So that, in other words, spirituality changes how you see things. Then they show you something and you report on what you see. So an answer I give today would be totally different than I gave 20 years ago. And it may be different than 20 years from now. That's why it's so important to understand that if something I say is in conflict with what your sponsor told you, go with your sponsor. I mean, just relax. You're just hearing what this person, what I see when I pick these pieces of paper up. Maybe sometimes it's something that I learned, but a lot of times it is simply, you know, like showing me a color, and I go, that looks purple. I mean, that's what I see, so then that's what I'm saying. So we'll go from there, and we'll go for a while. Oh, by the way, if there's a lot, I try to answer them very quickly. If we don't get through all of them, then and yours wasn't answered, just write it on a piece of paper with your name and address, and I'll type up an answer and mail it to you. And I promise that I'll do that. So if your question doesn't get read, don't worry about it. It will. If you want it answered, I'll be glad to do it. Sometimes they just, you guys put hard ones in, then it takes longer. Next time you learn. What was Bill W.'s last name? Okay, and thanks for submitting these. Any special recommendations or warnings for someone who is approaching his second anniversary? Any special recommendations? Well, show up. How do you know when you are doing God's will? Good question. Well, we're all thrilled. Approaching your second anniversary is wonderful. I mean, they all are wonderful. And they're earmarks and they're celebrations of how well AA works. So I would say be sure to give the credit to AA and just enjoy it. And how do we know if you're really doing God's will? Ask someone else. This is what I think God's will is for me. And go, 1, 2, 3. Do you agree that this is God's will for me? And there's humility. In other words, this is what I think God's will. If it's good, it'll pass tests and people will agree with you. So I run it by somebody else. That's a good answer to a lot of questions. What singular experience made you believe in a power greater than yourself? Two of them in early sobriety. One was at my first meeting. I'm not going to go through the whole story, but I've been sober 3 hours when the meeting started, and it was a five-hour meeting, and I was sober 8 hours when the damn thing ended. And I was on the front porch of this Oddfellows Hall in Manassas in the wintertime. It was kind of sleety, and I was trying to make a break for it. I just want to get out of there. All fanatics, and they're celebrating. Isn't sobriety wonderful? And an Al-Anon lady came out and put her hand on my shoulder. Her name was Betsy Lynch. And she probably saw where I was, and she just turned to me and said, come on back in, it's going to be fine. And I totally believed her. It was like an angel came out, and I just went, good. And I was getting ready to run. And I just walked in and felt wonderful. And then about 6 or 7 months, I was driving my car in the base at Quantico, Virginia. You know, I'm nervous about my career. Everything was... And I just heard a voice, even though it wasn't audible, that said, if you keep going to AA, everything will be fine. Those were the two big things. And then over the years, lots of things. And I've had more experience changes in the last 5 years than the previous 40. So don't give up. There's lots to happen out there. Good questions. Not too hard. My sober life is a miracle. If I do a 10th step, I think, what a wonderful day. I wish I'd been there for it. How can I fully inhabit and partake in my own life? We've been talking about it, and it involves abandoning all your old ideas, because the life you want to partake in is the one that isn't apparent yet. And the more you surrender, the more you will be in what is really your own life. The other thing is, technically, there's no such thing as your own life. There's life, and we're part of it. But there's no way of being separate from life itself. We're part of it. I used the story of the leaves on a tree. And we gave the egos to the leaves just to screw them up for a while. And they started seeing themselves as a separate entity from the tree, even though they're the leaf on the tree. And these leaves were on the bottom limb, and they were bigger, and they were complaining they didn't have as good a view as the leaves on the top of the tree. And all of this is because they created the idea they were separate from the tree. And they're not. They're just a part of it. And we are part of life. And we want to get rid of our own life, that separate part. And that's what dying is abandoning your own life into the total life of God. And so that's just sort of a spin-off on the end of that. What is your definition of truth? I don't have any answer. It's whatever is revealed. And that's where truth comes, as far as I'm concerned. It is sometimes a gradual awareness. A good example is we suddenly realize God is doing for us what we couldn't do for ourselves. There's a big moment of truth. Up until then, we're going, must be a coincidence. It must be the program is working. It must be. And then all of a sudden, it becomes apparent. And you see the same thing with the holograms. What's the truth in those pictures? There it is. But it was only revealed to you. And you could tell someone else, well, there's a sailboat that sticks out in the front, and they're not going to believe it till they see it. So truth to me is something that gets revealed, as opposed to you type it out and there it is, that's a true statement. And I realize on one level there is such things as that, but for my purposes it's revealed. It might be revealed to me when you tell your story. And then you have a way of explaining something that I had a similar experience to, and I go, bingo, that fills in the missing piece that I was looking for. You've probably had that while talking to people at the tables about what's going on. Somebody will go, boom, and then you go, yeah. So that, you see how it became. And truth resonates with our spirit. It just sits, and you just go, yes. There's just no conflict with it. All right. I stay conflicted between business decisions and program principles. Do you have any thoughts on this? Well, I would suggest reading Chuck's book, New Pair of Glasses, because he does the best job. I'm not a businessman. I never was. I don't know a damn thing about making money or business. I wrote stuff for various people, but he found that as he brought the principles into his business of putting his customers' interests ahead of his own profits, even if it made him experience a loss, he ended up getting more business and more profits than he ever could have dreamed of, because people were attracted to someone that honest. And so I would suggest taking a look at that. I don't know if we have it back there. We have some copies of it, and you can look at it and then decide if you want to buy it. It's relatively inexpensive, $6 or something, from Press and New Life Press in Los Angeles. How do I distinguish God's will from my will, and how do I stay in God's will? Okay. It's sort of a paradox in that what we want to do is get rid of our will. In other words, so that we aren't trying to figure this out, the conflict of my will and God's will. We're trying to get rid of it and not have a will. We were talking about that earlier. If you don't have a way, in other words, generally we have a way or a will. This is my observation. Because we're not happy and we're trying to figure out a way to get happy. And we determine that more money will do it. Now we're being willful about making money. So we create an energy force trying to cause something to happen. And that's willful. My will. I want the girlfriend to say yes. I want, you know, and we're willing these things. But we're not just doing it randomly. We're doing it because we're uncomfortable, we're not at peace with ourselves, and we're unhappy. So we envision our version of what will make us happy, and then we go after it. And then a lot of times we try to say, well, is that God's will that I'm trying to earn a lot of money and do this and that? And it's really the wrong question to try and answer. The question is, how can I get rid of my will? Now, let's just advance this thought. What if you got so close to God that you were at peace and happy all the time? Then why would you want to make a lot of money? You see, unless you wanted to donate it to some charity or something, because you wouldn't need it in order to make yourself happy. So the getting rid of the will and getting close to God eliminates having to deal with that question. And I just advance that. If you're already happy and totally at peace, you'll find your whole list of getting things done just becomes irrelevant. Why would I work that hard to get happy if I already am? Why do I need security if I know God's going to take care of me? You see what I'm saying? So the trick is to get rid of our own will. Otherwise, we're left with this, well, you know, calling your sponsor. You know, I had this thing appear to me last night to, I have this secretary, and I think if I ran off with her to Costa Rica, I picture myself, do you think that's God's will? And of course, your sponsor, he might run off with her himself, but he's not going to agree that that was God's will. I know that's a convoluted answer, but it's important to understand that the destruction of our will is the name of the game. It's not trying to make my way coincide with God's. That shows we want to keep having a thing called my way. If you were to choose one of the three Joel Goldsmith books to read first, which would it be? I think Thunder of Silence. As a matter of fact, I was trying to think of that title. This is just an author. He's back there. These are sometimes you'll mention an author. I won't have read them, so I'll have to say I don't have a clue. But I was going to use that line later on. Isn't that an interesting term, the Thunder of Silence? That's how powerful it can be when we can get a relationship with it that is really working. And silence has been called the space between thoughts, the space between words. Silence is the stage upon which all sound occurs. It's an incredibly spiritual force. I've been sober 18 plus years and still struggle with meditation. Any tips will be greatly appreciated. And I'm leaving off the names that are on here. Okay, I've mentioned this several times because I found it when I was in pain and when I had various things going on, that this really was still possible. And it appears to be universally true that the ego will allow you to take four breaths, you know, like you're going to start meditating. One, two, four. Before it wants to know what's going on. Do you follow what I'm saying? It kind of goes, it looks over, and there you go. Until you're very peaceful, and then it's going, what are you trying to not think? Hey, what we got things to do. What are you doing over there? Blah, blah, blah. And sometimes it'll be 10. But if you just say, I'm going to get four, and do that 100 times a day, you approximate a 20 to 25 minute quiet meditation, and it creates the same amount of space. And so you see, you've come up with something that's incredibly easy to do, and I've been doing it a long time, and my ego hasn't caught on. It doesn't realize what I'm up to, and sometimes I'll be up to 10 breaths without a single thought crossing my mind. And then they rush in. Okay, that's enough of that. What is going on? And then I just stop and go about. And so I found it, or a pain will come up and interrupt it or whatever. So there's a thought. And perhaps during the weekend, if other people have ideas, then they can get advanced. Let's see. Now, this is a question. It says on page 83 of the Big Book, we will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door. And how can I not regret the past? I understand not shutting the door on the past because if I forget where I came from, I'm on the way back. I've never been able to understand not regret the past. I know that I had to do what I did and go down as far as I went before I was able to surrender and start building a new life. I do regret the worry, the heartaches, the mental anguish that caused my mother and father for many years. I regret the physical and mental abuse I heaped on my children. I regret the damage done to others who cared about me, but most of all, my family. I worked on the steps. I got to 9. I made direct amends to all that I could. I made living amends. I've tried making living amends, family, for 20 years. I have a life today I never would have had. I do not dwell on my regrets, but I certainly wish that I had not have had to unjustly hurt the innocent people that I love and love the most. I simply cannot understand how I can not regret the past. It would seem extremely non-caring and callous if I didn't. I am not that person anymore. The instructions did not say to explain, but wanted to express my viewpoint. It also did not say to put my name on it, but I am. But I'm not going to. I know who it is, and I think it's a great question. And I'm sure a lot of people have thought about that. And I think we feel that we're being irresponsible if we were to let just go, okay, that's it. I'm going to just drop it. That's the end of it. But that is something that was taught to us, and it feeds into the ego. I think there are people in this world who feel, honestly, that if they aren't anguishing over something, they're being irresponsible. Do you follow what I'm saying? In other words, if I kind of followed my mother's role model, she was anguishing and kind of felt this was her contribution to the world, was to anguish. She'd read something in the paper and then anguish over it. And so you kind of felt like, well, God, I'm not anguishing. I'm just going to a ball game. Something is wrong with me that I'm not doing this. And so we come in the we have to get rid of that. If we keep carrying this around, it shows up in our energy around us. It makes us less attractive. It makes us less harmonious with our family. We've made amends, but we're still carrying this, and there's energy that doesn't need to be there when we're around them. It's just not necessary. If they have forgiven us, what are we still carrying it for? It's because the ego wants to have a standard and wants a weapon to keep beating us up with year after year. And so this is the reason that it stays there, but it does it by creating a good motive. I would be irresponsible if I simply dismissed this, like I don't care that it happened. But we've gone through the whole thing. Oh, thank you, Chris. We've gone through the whole process of our 12 steps. And this is how God wants us to fix this. But it's not good enough for us. I relate to this. I carried a whole bunch of stuff because of my perception of what the Catholic Church wanted me to do, which was to stay guilty forever. And here I am in the program, and so I carved out a place, a sort of a special exemption for me. I felt it was okay for you to let go of your past and not regret it. And if my people I'm sponsoring say, good for you. But I'm a little different. I have set up a rule inside of myself that says, if I stop regretting it, I'm being a bad person. Even if we took a vote all the way around the room here, and it was 54-1 that you're not a bad person, if your old ideas are strong enough, that won't be conclusive enough. We will still hold on to I am. And so if we've done all the steps, we've made the amends, and we have forgiven everyone for everything, then you'll see that that'll disappear. It's a real question because there's lots of people that have put themselves in that box and can't see an honorable way to get out of it. In a way, it's almost like the Al-Anon people when they teach them, you have to dump your husband or he won't get sober. It looks like a very cruel act, but that's what they go. Look, you, oh no, I love him, I can't put him in. I'm not saying they always say that, but it looks like you're being callous when you follow spiritual principles to save the alcoholic. It's very similar. What are the origins of the principles behind the 12 steps? I've heard, isn't that funny because somebody just gave me a CD on this. The origins of the principles behind the 12 steps. I've heard people say with certainty that a specific principle relates to a particular step, but I cannot find any documentation in our literature. This will probably be helpful to a lot of people who, and I wish I remember, I think it was somebody, LaRock, 1951, he was given a talk in Texas, somebody gave me this thing, and they said, this is the principles, you know, of honesty, surrender, whatever, and they're connected to each of the 12 steps, but it's nowhere in writing anywhere. But people have made up a list and passed it around, but it didn't come out of and the official AA. And this guy, oh, what a beautiful speaker. It must have been like a teacher or something. It's a great CD. And he said, it was 1951, he got sober probably in 1941 or somewhere in there. He had about 10 years. And he said, we were sitting around his home group and they were looking at the 12 steps and it said, practice these principles in all our affairs. And they said, what are the principles that we're practicing? And they said, I don't know what they are. Why don't we think about it and see if we could figure them out? And so they sat around, and we could do that today. We could go, why don't we all try to come up with a unanimous decision on what's the principle behind step one? And we might say surrender or whatever it is. And they were very creative principles. I could certainly connect to them. But at the end of the thing, he said, now you might do the same thing in your group and come up with different principles. So now you see, these are the principles, but they aren't the principles. Do you see the difference? There is no the official principles. And I'm sure if we went, we're great historians, we would find that somebody probably in Cincinnati did that and came up with different principles that would be equally perfect. And so, isn't that funny? I just listened to that 2 days ago. I've seen those lists floating around. people refer to them as the principles. And so I would call it, that is a set of principles that seems to be helpful to people. And then we can take it out of the official category. And while I'm along those lines, I asked a lot of old, I did a survey some years ago, and I said, when did the promises appear? Because there were no promises when I got sober. If you had asked anybody in AA in 1964 what the promises were, they would have gone, I don't know. Somebody saw them. Our best guess was about 20 years ago. Someone looked at that, the end of the ninth step, and said, hey, here's a bunch of promises. And next thing, they're on plastic. And next thing, it's the promises. And then the fifth step promises appeared. And then in our area, they're reading stuff from everywhere. Well, why don't I read the 10th step promises? Why don't, you know, if you go in the 12 and 12 in the big book, you can find a bunch of sentences that have will in it. Any sentence with a will in it is a promise. So I said, they asked me to read the promises one night, and I said, I'm going to read the final promise. You will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. So that was the final promise, because it's on page 164. So there's official, and then there's semi-official. And those things, the promises and the principles, are semi-official, and they're fun, and they're useful. But they didn't, you know, you can't find in the archives where they came from. What kind of connection is there between thinking and meditation? Boy, how about a bad one? It would be nice if there was no connection at all and you could just meditate. We're trying to get rid of thinking, and it's too bad there's a connection. There's too bad you can't be free of thinking by just hitting a switch and then just sit in the silence and wait to hear God's will or to hear peace or to hear all that's available from that other world. And yet, we're going to read books on meditation and use our thinking to get into meditation. So it's a catch-22. In order to get there, you have to use your thinking, but the trick is to use your thinking to get rid of your thinking. And so you can see you get into a funny area to get started. And this on the wall here was this teacher's entire meditation program. It was just that one sentence. You just focus on that and sit there, and basically anytime you start feeling that something should be different than it is, you get rid of it. And that's it. That's the whole thing. So that's what I say about a connection. It's in a way, it's too bad that you can't shut off the thinking. Okay. Oh. How do we reconcile letting others to be free to do as they wish with being a responsible parent? To say, oh boy, this is a good question. A 16 or 18-year-old. I've got two daughters in AA. And so I know what you're talking about. They're out in the streets. I can't let them be out there. I have to go fix it. I have to... Da, 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 da. And then you try as hard as you can, and they still are out there. And then you feel you haven't tried hard enough. And we got to, and of course, Al-Anon is a wonderful... I would go to Al-Anon with this baby and learn how to responsibly detach. And I think I've been in the program long enough to realize that this was their experience. This is their bottom. This is their life. This is their connection with God. And there was, I'm sure you've heard speakers, they go around, don't forget, God has no grandchildren. You ever heard that sentence? God has no grandchildren. God doesn't go through me to my kid. goes directly. He doesn't go through me. There's a line in the big book, I've always felt, and I said, Bill, geez, I can't believe you said that. It's in Family Order Wives. And the wife is wanting to know why her husband hasn't stopped drinking. Does anybody remember this sentence? And this is what he said. Listen, God has either removed your husband's obsession to drink, or he hasn't. Now, don't you feel irresponsible if you were to just accept that? Well, my daughter's dying out there, but God had removed the obsession, so I'll be on my way. But it's inviting us to think along those lines. And so I used to go, my ex-wife would call me. She's down in Orlando. She's lying there, and some drug dealer took all her money, and she's out in the thing. You got to go over. And my main job was to calm my ex-wife down, to make her at peace, to assure her that I would, in fact, do everything that was possible. So and then she was able to have peace of mind. And then one time, something told me it was time to go over there. So I flew down from Washington. I got a motel room near where she stayed in Orlando. She now has 8 years. So I went over there, and it was about 5 o'clock at night, and it turned out she was in the house with her girlfriend of hers. They were drinking buddies, and they were really well on their way. And I hadn't seen her in a few years. So I knock on the door. She opened the door, and the top of her lung, she shouted, "Here's my asshole father." And then she just started in, "You're the worst father ever." And then people are coming out of their houses, and she's just screaming and screaming. So I stayed a little while, and then I said, "Oh, I'll come back by in the morning." Well, in the morning, we're hungover. It's a different story. And she was working for Piedmont Airlines then, and we went over there and enrolled her in their alcohol program. There wasn't that much resistance. And she went in, but she went back out a few more times, and then she's been sober ever since. So I think the reason Al-Anon is so powerful is they have gone through the same situation, and they give you permission, which you cannot give to yourself, to take this detachment and utilize it so that you don't ruin your own sobriety in an effort to cause something to happen that you can't cause to happen. You almost need other parents to say, look, it's okay to, and then follow their guidance. So that's a very big question, and anybody with kids is going to run into that. If sobriety is a gift, God either has or he hasn't removed the compulsion. I'm pretty good. I knew this was coming, so I quoted the page in the big book. If sobriety is a gift, God either has or he hasn't removed the compulsion to drink, why would he withhold it? Okay, we're asking a question that's a mystery. There's no way of knowing why God does anything. So we have to surmise, okay? There is no answer to this. Why would God do anything? Why did he create the universe? Why did he make the Brooklyn Dodgers lose all the time? I mean, I'm...
Big bang.
Right. But I understand the thing. What it implies is that since the compulsion is still there, that God doesn't want to remove it. I have no idea. I know that unless some very painful, difficult things happen to me, I would not be where I am now. And very often, very unfair and painful things happen, and then later on we go, we were talking to Brian, look, you went through all that, and then you're grateful that it happened, and you're back, And so, it certainly isn't because he's a mean person and wants to hurt somebody. It's going to be revealed. That would be my best answer. Wait and see, and then we'll find out. And generally the person might say, if they get sober, that, well, it took all that before I was even willing to let God in. So you can't answer questions about trying to figure what God's motives are. But I spent a lot of time doing that. Why would he allow wars? Why would he do it? And I think it was a desire to not get close to God. And it was the way I wanted to stay separate. What time do we start, Chris?
3 o'clock.
3 o'clock. We're going to take a break in a minute. We're getting there. We're halfway. How is it that despite working a strong program, in my case, 9 years, I still have periods of high anxiety? I have no secrets. Work the steps. Am active in sponsorship and service. These occasional periods can be very discouraging. Well, we all recognize that when Bill was writing the 12 and 12, he was in depression that was just awful. And he carried on in spite of those. And it was certainly not a reflection that he wasn't working a good program. It wasn't as if he was doing something wrong. I had anxiety so high I used to come close to fainting in the early meetings. And somebody told me to embrace it, to don't fight it, that when it came, welcome it. After all, it's your anxiety. You know, just bring it in. It's part of you. Don't say you don't like it. Just go, all right, I'm experiencing anxiety. I'm willingly going to experience anxiety. I did the same thing with pain. I embraced it. Because if there's no way to measure increments of pain or anxiety, but let's say you could measure it on some sort of a scale, and I was getting 50 units of pain. When I decide that I shouldn't have this, I don't like it, and I don't want it, I run it up to 100 by fighting it, because now I'm angry at it. I can't believe it. And then run around telling Chris, I can't believe it. And then when I just went back to, this is what's on your plate today. Just take it and just sit there and see what you can learn about pain. Where does it start? And I think the anxiety is in the same boat, that if you embrace it, you'll reduce it, because you won't be fighting it. The fighting causes it to double. It practically does. I was frightfully slow in accepting my powerlessness in anything in my life that wasn't drinking. Oh, I see. Relationships, finances, attitudes at work. Yet I was around sober members of AA who were trying to give me the message. What are some interesting ways to try and get people in their first 5 or 10 years of sobriety to see their powerlessness besides just letting the pain grind them down? What a good question. Because the pain will grind them down where they are powerless. I think I would approach this with the same thing I was talking about earlier, by asking them if they're happy. You say you're not powerless over it, that you're able to control it. Have you been able to make yourself happy? Have you controlled your finances, relationships, or whatever it is, so that you're happy, joyous, and free in those areas? And if they say, no, I'm still miserable, then I think you're powerless over it, because you can't make yourself happy in any of those areas. And generally, they'll just go, well, yeah, there's no way I can make myself happy. Yeah, there's no way you can make yourself happy in relationships. You might need help. You are powerless to make yourself happy with finances, relationships, or whatever any of that is. It's really a telling thing, because the person has to say that they're not happy, or they wouldn't be raising all this, if fighting it. If somebody is totally happy without doing any of the steps, without using God, I wouldn't talk to them at all. I would just go, great, geez, that's just wonderful, because there's nothing there to fix. So why mess with it? I just don't think it can last, but one more, we'll take a break. How do we reconcile the broad, roomy, all-inclusive nature of our path with the reality? With the reality that it nonetheless still requires rigorous, thorough adherence to definitive, though simple framework, the steps. I think this ties into what we were talking about in the last lecture. If I'm reading this right, the all-inclusive, it's kind of like the language in the third step of the 12 and 12. This great openness of AA, no matter what your background, there's this all-inclusiveness. You come in, you're an atheist, a communist, a Jesus believer, an agnostic, I hate this, I'm bad, old, young, whatever it is. This thing is all-inclusive. There's no requirements, just a desire to stop drinking, to come through the hoop. But as we start down the path, then it starts getting narrower. And so it's all-inclusive, it's very wide. I don't know, if the person who wrote this wants to ask me afterwards, I'll be glad to talk to him whether I'm missing the point of this. And it requires rigorous action, not to come in through the hoop, but to keep making progress, to keep moving on the spiritual path. What is the rigorous action? Fighting with our ego. Trying to let go of it and allow God to take over. That's the fight. That's the rigorous action that we're talking about. That's 50 minutes. Let's take 10 or 15 minutes. Get Chris. 10 minutes. All right, 10-minute break, and then we'll come back and see how far we can get. And then we'll get ready for the silence. And these are great questions. Okay, we're into the final session of question and answers before we go into the silence. And I think they're great questions. I hope the answers are useful. And like I say, these are not the answer. Speaking of other spiritual literature you've read outside the Big Book and 12 Traditions, what other book is one of your favorites? Well, a lot of C.S. Lewis, The Great Divorce, Mere Christianity. Recently, I can't think of this. He's from India. We have it back there. I Am That, which one of our members made me aware of. And it's, an awakened person who followed the directions of his spiritual leader when he was a kid, not well educated. And he just lives in a little shack, and seekers from all over the world come to him from other countries and so on down. And they ask him questions, and then he answers them. And the book is just the questions and the answers. And the reason I like it, because, you know, an intellect has fun with that. The person asks the question, I answer it, and then I read his answer. I mean, you know, I answer it mentally, and then I read his answer, and I go, wow, I wasn't even close. So if you like doing that, being perpetually frustrated, I find that book. I find that book kind of fun. The New Earth, who wrote that? The Power of Now? Eckhart Tolle. For some unknown reason, and this will just show you that if somebody recommends a book, you pick it up and you go, man, I don't get it. Keep the book, because you'll pick it up 10 years from now and you go, wow, this is freaking amazing. Because I picked up The Power of Now and I put it down after about 15 pages. And then somebody said, well, he wrote another one. Well, you know, that's right. And I picked it up and I went, oh my God, this is wonderful. So, same author. So you can see a lot of it has to do with timing. A lot of it has to do with where you're at right now as to whether this is the right teacher at the right time. So that's why it's hard to have a universally accepted book that where everybody in the room said, yeah, I picked it up, it was perfect. It just isn't going to happen. But those are the ones that occur to me off the top of my head. Why do you sometimes have a complete lack of control over our defects of character? Please speak to the riddle of our existence. Do you all know what that is? That's a line in the 12 and 12. And I talk about it a lot. Why do I sometimes have a complete lack of control over my defects of character? It's impossible to control our defects of character. We can try, but we can't do it. We're powerless over controlling our defects of character. We can exercise some restraint so that we don't get angry enough to murder, but we get angry enough to buy a gun, if you follow what I'm saying. That's why we need God. We don't want to be figuring out how to control our defects of character. We want to ask God to do the work. And sometimes you hear, well, I'll do the legwork and God will do the rest. God will be glad to help with the legwork. He'll be glad to help sweep the kitchen. See, we constantly come up with phrases that imply God wouldn't help with that in order to keep him out. I'll take care of this part of it, God. We're always wanting to. So we make up stuff like that. You know, if faith is going to move a mountain, bring a shovel. Well, why have faith? In other words, we can't mix the two metaphors. Either we're going to be spiritual or not. Now, the riddle of our existence, very quickly, I could spend 15 minutes on this, but it's in step 6 in the 12 and 12, and it comes where it says, we're entirely ready to have God remove all the defects of character, which implies perfection. It says all. And then we go, well, why do I still have all mine? And sometimes we fall back on, and I don't want to, if you believe otherwise, then you'd stay with that. But sometimes we fall back on the 7-step prayer to explain why we still have some of our character defects. Because it says, remove the defects that are standing in the way of my usefulness. So we assume that God wants us to have all the other defects, and he only is going to remove the ones that are going to interfere with us helping somebody. So it's God's fault that I'm still an asshole. It's not me that has anything to do with this. And I could see, if you read that, you could see that that's exactly what it says. But if you read the 12 and 12, you'll see that the same author certainly doesn't agree with that, that we are praying to have all our defects removed, and that certainly will enable us to be useful to others. And that's the reason to get them removed. And we apply this to drinking. We do become, in fact, entirely ready to have it removed. And it is removed. Why do we still have all the others? That's the riddle of our existence. We have absolute proof that if you get entirely willing and humbly ask, it's gone. So the reason they're still there is me. I don't want them removed. I'm not entirely ready to have lust removed. And he said, now the reason for this might be in the mind of God. That's what Bill wrote. We don't know the exact answer. But his guess is alcohol was killing us. So the ego saw that if we don't get rid of that, I won't be around to screw with you anymore. So I'm going to let you be entirely willing to have alcohol removed. And it was. The other ones aren't killing us. They really are, but they aren't killing us like alcohol was. So we don't have the urgency that was associated with the drinking. That's why we have to work so hard to become willing and to go through the pain of having them removed. So he was trying to guess That was the riddle, and he says it might be only in the mind of God. That's a good question. What do you do for fun? Well, I used to play golf, and I ran, and I can't do any of those things. I know this sounds egotistical, but I just sit around and make myself laugh. My mind is just, it is fun to hang around. I'm just in there and, holy shit. I think there's a, you know, whoo. I mean, I did have a straitjacket on for a long time, but it's really fun to be in here. I just wouldn't trade it for anything, so that's what I do for fun. That's why I'm having fun all the time. Humbleness. I know I'm screwing up in my personal life, but I am too proud to seek help. God, this is us. Boy, anybody in here that doesn't relate to this question, raise your hand. Having issues with sex behavior. Anybody in here that isn't having issues with... So this question was written by the whole room. Boy, I think men are particularly... There's so much pleasure out of all aspects of sex that it just seems like you shouldn't have to give that up totally. And if there's ever an example of settling for the middle ground, it's on the sex issue with men. And so if you're in that, you are exactly where everybody else is. And the first thing that I do, I have the same problems everybody has, is that I accept that that's who I am. I have this defect. This is who I am, so I don't get mad at myself having it. After all, as Bill wrote in the 12 and 12 in step 4, these instinctual drives were given to us by God. We've somehow let them go beyond where he intended that they go, but we didn't put them there in the first place. And so it's a real challenge to have that be subdued. We call it the sex demand. And God is available to help us reduce that demand. Our old way was to try and satisfy it by more. And of course, you can't do that. And we can laugh at ourselves and we continue to go down that dead alley. Okay, one more time. Whatever it is. I'll get the porn channel on, but I'll only be there for 10 minutes. Whatever it is. I'm going over to the massage parlor and just have a political conversation. I just wonder how the girls feel about Obama. You know? And if we see how ridiculous this is, we can start laughing at ourselves instead of condemning ourselves. That is a sin, to condemn ourselves for being filled with faults. So we got to stop that. We just have to stop that. And then we're going to, year by year, take whatever steps we can to reduce this demand and allow God to reduce it, to let go, and to seek to get closer to God so that we're extremely happy and complete and don't need anything other than what we already have. Then it's real easy to give things up because they won't fix anything. Because they're really trying to fix us from being incomplete, unhappy. At least I'll have some fun. So acknowledge it. You're the same as everybody in this room. Don't condemn yourself and just allow God in as best you can. And that's why we're here. We're seeking to get closer to God, which automatically will work on this. What is your definition of humility and being humble? Oh, boy. I when I get my medallion every year and they say, how did you do it? I say, I want to stay in a state of constantly receiving help. And I think that's what humility is to recognize the best deal I can have is to constantly be receiving help, to constantly be getting feedback. Ask Carl, ask you, what do you think about this? What do you think? Do you think I should do it too? And that keeps me from being in charge of my own life. It is, it's that part of us that wants God to run everything. And that's why we've got to stay with it until it happens. So that's my best shot. There's many, many definitions. That's what I see today. What was the one thing in sobriety that you found you were wrong about that most impacted your spiritual growth? Wow, I've been wrong about so many things. I don't know. I don't have the answer, but I'm going to... When I went to AA and I looked around the room, I decided which people were worth listening to before they talked. And I eliminated anybody from the South. How do you like that, Southerners? I eliminated women. What the hell could they know? And this is in my mind. All right, yeah, she's up. Now I'm going to really concentrate on him. Who did I concentrate? Somebody who looked just like me. You know what I mean? Somebody who looks at my age and white. And then, now, here comes the answer. And then here comes this guy with a third grade education. And I skip him. But then later on, I'm going, what the hell did he say? And then I suddenly find myself waiting for him to talk. And I realized all the judgments I made in my mind, you could call them prejudices. I was prejudiced against old people, Southerners, black people, Hispanic people, anybody that wasn't me. And I think it's so wonderful to be wrong about all that and to realize your teacher is going to be the most unlikely person. You know, how many people you know went to Harvard and they have a biker for a sponsor? With tattoos all over him. Oh, this is the greatest guy in the world. He's the most spiritual man I've ever met. Off he goes, and you go, really? Doesn't look that way. So I think that's the single thing was that I stopped, and I love to listen to everybody. And I realized we all are the same. The package may be a little different, but boy, are we the same. That was my favorite thing to be wrong about. All right, do you believe there's such a thing as the alcoholic mind? Or is that a term the ego has invented to differentiate the alcoholic from the normal person who also suffers from the thinking mind? I don't think that the ego did it. I think AA did it. We just made up a thing that there's a disease of alcoholism, therefore there must be an alcoholic mind, and there must be this, and there must be that. And then we realized exactly what this writer said, that all the people out there have the same problems. There's no one out there that has any problems different than we do. So what makes us different? We found a solution that didn't work for them. It was called drinking. We found a solution to the problem that they all have, and we'd like to share it with them, but they won't vomit. They won't cough up blood. They've got no guts. They won't do that. So that's why they're not alcoholic, and we are. And so we have a common problem and a common solution. But when we're in here, we go, well, alcoholic thinking set in, an alcoholic mind, an alcoholic this. And I agree that all those people out there think the same way. And there's crazy people out there, and there's one of everything out there. But it is, we are the same. We have the same human struggle, only a... Like us before we got here, they have no idea that the real problem they have is they can't get rid of their longing for God. And their sense of being incomplete has nothing to do with the material world. And you can keep earning money till you can't put it in the bank and you still won't be happy. And so we are all alike. Perhaps I have enough spiritual illumination to light my own path, but how do I become a beacon for others? You don't. You either are or you aren't. And a lot of times you don't even know that you're a beacon for others. A lot of times the awakening inside of you, the transformation that gets started, other people in your home group see it long before you do. And then you become aware that, I really am different now. I have a whole different way of looking at things. And it becomes an individual program of attraction. Somebody's going to be attracted to you. Not necessarily by what you said, just because of the energy that's coming out of you. There's something, and they just want to come. Can I ask you something? That's when it happened. Can I ask you, could I talk to you for a minute? So they saw something in you that they want. And it's an indefinable thing, but we generally associate it with awakening. And that there is this light or aura or whatever it is, a sense of joy, whatever it is. And then the person comes, and then you get to transmit it to that person. And you have now fulfilled the highest act that a human being can do, which is to show someone else how to awaken. There's nothing beyond that. It's the highest act that anybody can do. If that happens through you, you didn't do it, it happens through you as an instrument. It's the most beautiful thing to watch. And that's really why we keep coming back, so we can participate in that. Okay, we're getting there. Would you discuss the concept of acceptance in context of that part of the Serenity Prayer which asks for the courage to change the things we can? You've asked the question of a person who doesn't like the Serenity Prayer. So let me. and Dr. Paul used to talk about that. He said, I never put that in my story, because people kept coming up to him. Acceptance is the key to everything. So that's the end of that. So we'll drop out the rest of the Serenity Prayer. You follow what I'm saying? No matter what is accepted. Okay. Well, what about the wisdom to know? You don't need to know the difference. You just accept it. Well, you can't just accept it. And then we start the discussion. Anything that happens has to be accepted that it happened. I was just in an accident and got my arm cut off. How could you not accept that? Your arm's gone. You can go, I don't want it to be this way. I don't. But you have to accept good or bad. Now, in order for something to fit in the category of having to be accepted, we have to make a judgment about it. You don't hear people at meetings having a discussion about, I just got promoted and I'm having a hard time accepting it. I just inherited $50,000. I'm having a real struggle with acceptance on that. So it seems that we have to classify something as shouldn't have happened in order to generate the need for acceptance. Do you follow what I'm saying? In other words, we have to make a judgment about something that it shouldn't have happened. And now that judgment created the need for acceptance. And so a lot of times when I'm working with people and they have a problem, I try to go through the drill of convincing them they don't have a problem, that their assessment of the situation is incorrect. It's just something that happened. It's not a problem. What is bothering me? I know, but I know how to get you unbothered without the situation being changed. So if I can get you undisturbed, is it still a problem that needs to be accepted? Anybody got a problem that's not bothering them today? Anybody got a problem that's not bothering you? There's no such thing as a problem that isn't bothering you. So if we got rid of the bother, we got rid of the problem, we got rid of the need to accept. So that's a separate thing about acceptance. It's a place where I've taken my mind into a dead end and I don't know how to get out. But acceptance in the serenity prayer, if we were to go back to, and let's use the prayer and forget that Dr. Paul was right. We'll go back and say the serenity prayer is right. And then you can have this discussion in your home group. Who was right, Dr. Paul or the serenity prayer? Well, we'd probably end up in a fist fight, but it will be fun. And I wish you the best of luck. Okay. In order, let's start at the end. In order to ask God for the wisdom about anything, you have to be undisturbed. Or you can't hear it. Would everybody agree with that? You can't be furious and hear God's guidance. So we have to get undisturbed for the serenity prayer to work. In order to get undisturbed, we have to accept what happened. We can't be fighting it anymore. We can't be furious that it happened. It happened. Now, undisturbed, just because we accept it, doesn't mean that we might not want to do something about it. If somebody does something to me, I'm so angry I want to sue them. I should definitely not sue anybody when I'm angry, because it could be a mistake. What if the spiritual part of me, totally calm, wants to let it go? So I want to get to being undisturbed, and then I'll decide it's not worth it. I'm going to forgive them and move on. See, that's a different course of action. That's a different course of action than I would have taken had I done it when I'm angry. So you have to accept to get undisturbed in order to be eligible to get the guidance from God. And so acceptance is absolutely essential, even though we might want to change something. Does that make sense? If not, that's the best shot I've got. I got into a tough area there. I can do the same thing with patients. Anyway, a school bus filled with nuns. Oh, boy. Is everybody already into it? Isn't this fun? This is going to be great. A school bus filled with nuns and orphans explodes for no apparent reason. A huge tragedy. Many are grieving and asking, how could God let this happen? It could be that those who died are the lucky ones. Now they know. So how might one console those who are mad at God? Actually, we don't need all the rest of it, that last question, the last line. How can we console someone who is mad at God? Well, obviously, it would have to be one-on-one. I'm not going to do it in front of a bunch of other people. It would be that you really want to take on this and help them with it. Number two, what I like to think about is, what do we know about God as far as human beings are concerned? We know that there's 6.7 billion, and we know they're all going to die. Okay, we know that for a fact. Does anybody say, why does God let that happen? We just go, of course, that's in order for there to be life, there has to be death. In order for there to be death, there has to be life. So yes, I accept that as normal. I don't know anybody who wouldn't accept that as normal. That all 6.7 billion people on planet Earth are going to die. Anybody think that's a tragedy? No, that's fine. So now we're down to, when do you die? Do you follow that? Under what circumstances should one die? And you suddenly realize that death is so natural that it isn't anything to be concerned about. It is just like I could make the case that a breath has a beginning and a death. It's born. It's dead. That breath lived and died just like that. And yet, we sustain ourselves on breath living and dying. The biggest cause of death is birth. That's the biggest cause. And so I think it's important to make people comfortable with death. Did you ever bring death up at a meeting? It gets kind of quiet in there. Why don't we bring up the topic of death this noon? And we'll go around the room and see. And I would submit that if you can do that often enough until that topic is the same as resentment, we've come a long way. We've come a long way in our own. See, our ego loves to use death. It's its favorite weapon to shoot down that there's God. There's a, what about death? Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And so it centers around that. Now, I'm not doing a very good job of consoling the person who saw the bus blow up with all the people in it. There is no... I don't think there's any magic answer there. They're going to have their personal journey, and they're either going to eventually choose God and live with the results, or they're going to hate God and live with the results of that. I would love to help them change their mind. That's about... We could talk about that one. I'm sure if I got people to come up here, they could do a better job than I did. Sometimes simply allowing everything to be as it is seems irresponsible. I'm delighted that that produced that. That, I think we were talking about that earlier. If you're not anguishing over something, you're being irresponsible. Time? We ran out of...
We had 75 minutes right now on the tape.
Oh, your tape's going to run out.
Oh, I thought we were going to do a separate CD for each session.
We are. Oh, I didn't know that.
Ah.
I can flip it. Keep going. I'll flip it to another CD.
Well, let's just... What do you think, Chris? We won't have the rest of the questions on there, or we'll stop? Huh? Just we'll do the questions and they won't be on the... How do you guys want? You want to stop? Start another CD?
Start another CD.
Are you sure? Okay, yeah, I'm sorry. I thought we would have a separate CD for each session. All right, John, I'm so sorry. We should have gone over that. I can do 15. Are you on another one, or do you want me to wait?
No, just keep going.
Oh, keep going. Okay. Simply allow me, it sounds irresponsible. How does planning for the future, like retirement, etc., find its way into this way of life? Okay, I think I may have been talking about that. That if our relationship with God is right, you won't find you're worrying about retirement. You just already know you're going to be taken care of. There is a freedom in total reliance on God. The ego says it's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. God won't take care of you. What, do you think he's going to show up with a sandwich? He might. I don't rule that out. I've never seen anybody in AA that didn't have a sandwich that day, even though they hadn't had a job in 4 months or 5 months. We go back to Chuck. There's only one problem that includes all problems, and one solution that includes all solutions. The problem of worrying about retirement is not being close enough to God. The problem of worrying about retirement will go away when you get close enough to God. That's either true or it isn't. And you won't be able to, you have to go do it to find out if in fact it's true. And we hate simplicity. We hate that this could possibly be the whole deal. Just, it's got to be more complicated because I'm more complicated. And then we come up with, what about, well, da-dee-da-da. And none of that's happening right now. All of this worry is about the future. And if we're living in the present moment, it's impossible to have any of that happen. Okay? I once heard someone say there is no wrong reason for doing the right thing. Do you have any thoughts on this? I think I would agree with that. Let's say, take a ridiculous thing that a new member at a meeting, somebody wanted to ride home, and he offered to give him a ride home because that would put him near the bar that he wanted to go to anyway. So his reason for giving the guy a ride home was so he could go get a drink. But the guy got a ride home. And so the act actually is a good act, even though the motive was bad. The trick is, he's not going to grow spiritually for doing that right act with the wrong motive. But I hope people keep doing good acts for the wrong motive because it benefits all the rest of us. But they won't grow spiritually from it. And when his interest is in spiritual growth, then he will be tying the motive behind the action. So that way you get a ride home. How do you practice contact, conscious contact with God? I don't know if we have the book back there called Practicing the Presence by Brother Lawrence. It's written in maybe 500 years ago by a brother. He wasn't even smart enough to be a monk, and he just was limited to doing the... he wasn't educated enough, so they made him a brother, and he worked on shoes and things in the monastery. And he learned how to practice the presence of God so well that people read this book 500 years later. And it's a constant attempt to be in a dialogue with God at all times. Well, God, we're on the way to the meeting. Well, God, we're going here. I was telling people at lunch or somewhere, maybe I've already covered this here, it's kind of like the movie Harvey. And Jimmy Stewart has this imaginary rabbit, and he talks to him all the time. Well, Harvey, we're at the doctor's office. Well, Harvey, we're here. That is constant conscious contact. And I recommend that book highly. If we don't have it, it's Practicing the Presence by Brother Lawrence.
I have a copy if somebody would like to read it over the next couple hours.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, at least take a look at it. Just see his language on one page. He writes letters to some of the nuns that are having problems with God, and he's giving them advice. And it's really, it's so simple. It's wonderful. How does living with physical pain affect your spiritual life? How does the experience help you to grow? Do you believe that pain is God's megaphone? I don't know. He's been yelling at me lately. I think I talked about this, that it broke my contact with God. It shattered it, and the sad thing is that surprised me because I had so much spiritual pride, I didn't think pain could touch it. And so what did I learn out of it? I learned that I'm human. I learned a lot more humility, and I learned to embrace pain. And I learned that don't fight it and try to help other people and try to do other things. So there was a lot of lessons in it. And it's the only way to get rid of the ego is going to be painful because it doesn't want to go. And so he's just going to fight you. You can call it a wrestling match, and then those are painful in a way, but they also achieve good results. All right, Chris, how many more? Five. Four. What would be a good daily action plan to get close close to God look like? What would a daily? I don't have a daily action plan. I don't have anything organized that I like a handout. But a lot of speakers do, and a lot of people do. I mean, those are very helpful to people. I just get up and see what's going to happen. That's my plan. I just kind of go. When I get a, I do this, that when I get a problem, I say, I wonder how this turns out.
because it's none of my business. I'm just going to see how it turns out. And then you watch it, and the damn things turn out. They're going to turn out. You can't stop them from turning out. And so I think that's it. I don't have a plan. One day I'll get up and read some spiritual stuff. The next day I'll get up and make some eggs. You know what I mean? But maybe when I'm making the eggs, I'm more spiritual than when I'm reading the spiritual thing. You remember I've written several, you know, from China, some of those books. I remember this line. When you're making the tea, just make the tea. Has anybody ever read that? Don't make the tea and be figuring out how you're going to close a sale at 9 o'clock. Just make the tea, which is why the Japanese have the tea ceremony. This is it. Tea, boom, and that's all you're doing. You're totally in the now. So I don't really have a plan. Okay, I love the big book. How sound is it to you? I love the big book. I mean, God, I love the big book. But as I described it, it's the treasure map and not the treasure. It leads you to God, and that's the purpose of the book. That's why it's so wonderful, is that it works every time. It just works. If we follow that, you will find God. And so that's why I love the big book. All right, this will be it. And then there's about four left. If I didn't answer yours, either come up and ask me, or just write it on a piece of paper with your name, or come up and find it and hand it to me with your name and address, and I'll think about it and send you an answer. Is passing it on the reason we go to AA? I go because I want to stay sober. That's a good question. And this is my own personal view. My own personal view. So, and I know none of your sponsors. Probably I shouldn't even say it. Lois Wilson made the statement that after Bill's spiritual awakening, she said, he'll never drink again. That's how positive she was because of the spiritual awakening. Now, I've looked at all this stuff, and then I've had my own experience. And this is how I feel. I feel that if he made those phone calls in the Mayflower Hotel and got no connection with anybody, he wouldn't have taken a drink. That's what I think. I think he would have started again the next day and made some more phone calls, but I don't think he would have taken a drink. Now, there are many other people who study AA history, and they would say he was hanging on the ropes, and if that connection hadn't been made, he would have been a goner. Who can prove either way? I can't say I'm right, and I can't say the people who feel the other way are right. I really believe that because I feel that's how strong mine was. I may commit suicide. I may do a lot of other things, but I don't think I'll ever take a drink. And so I'm at meetings to pass it on. That's why I'm at meetings. And I want to get better at carrying the message. I want to find better ways of expressing that. That's just what I think. My sobriety is dependent on my relationship with God, and I believe that every day that I am carrying his message, I'm free to carry the message. So I know that's almost blasphemy to say that you don't think you'll take a drink. But I'm so absorbed in the joy of passing it on, it just seems impossible in my own mind. And so that isn't part of why I'm there. I never thought of taking a drink in 44 and a half years. The thought has never entered my mind. And if I saw it and said, oh, look at the beard, that would be, I went, no, it wouldn't. It's almost like I don't understand how alcohol works now. I don't understand what it could possibly do. And I don't know what that means, but I know that it just is, doesn't make sense to me that it could help with anything. So that's a different place that I used to be. It's my view of it is I just don't get it anymore. I don't know what possible thing that could do. Now, if 12 cheeseburgers, yeah, I'll go eat all of those. That makes sense. And then I'm sick and I'm doing all the crazy things. But in other words, the alcohol looks like poison now. It just does. So let's not end on that question. That's John, can you take that answer off of that? Oh, I'm going to hear about this one, aren't I, Carl? Okay, you guys from California, don't call me about that. Jesus, I wish I hadn't said that. What is the most unusual event that you've experienced at a meeting? Yay! All right, now we got some fun. We'll end on this. This is the finale question, and then the other ones. What is the most unusual event that you have experienced while speaking? Let me see the most unusual event at a meeting. Oh, it's on my tape somewhere where my sponsor had me get a speaker. He wanted me to become the program chairman at our little group. And it was way down in Quantico, and the speakers had to drive. Now, California, you guys won't think any of this, but they had to drive like 45 minutes, which was a long ways. And so I was afraid to ask people. They might say no, but it's coming up. He's got the speakers for about 3 weeks. So I finally see this Army major from Belvoir. There was a group near Belvoir, and I went, Jack, can you come down and speak Sunday night? And he said, yeah, I'd be glad to. And I went, oh, thank God. And I didn't have the courage to ask anybody else. I didn't really have a second speaker. I told Bill, he said, where is it? He'll be here. He'll be here, my sponsor. Where's the other speaker? He'll be here. I was so nervous about it. Anyway, we had a jockey in that group, a little guy named Dave, who would come drunk and then to be sober the next week. And then he's drunk. And we just knew that he was going to be there. He was there that night. I read the preamble and I did all that. And then I go, here's Jack, our first speaker. And Jack got up. I didn't know he was drunk. And he got up and he said, my name's Jack, I'm an alcoholic, I'm here tonight to resign from Alcoholics Anonymous. And then he went on and on about, before I came to AA, whenever I drank a lot, I got drunk and I got all screwed up, but you people have showed me how to drink. Now I can drink safely. And of course, I'm going, oh my God, I'm going to be thrown out of AA. And I wouldn't even look at my sponsor, who, unbeknownst to me, was falling on the floor with laughter. Because he thought it was so funny. And that guy might still be talking, except for the jockey. He listened to that for about 15, 20 minutes, and he jumped up and he said, you're a damn liar. You can't drink a fifth of whiskey and not get drunk. I can't drink. I got a fifth outside. You come outside with me. We'll go out there, and I'll show you. And he went out, and I just stayed there. And my sponsor had to get up, and he said, why don't we all come back next week and see what Sandy has? And quickly, the most unusual thing speaking was in the Texas State Convention in San Antonio in probably in the 70s. And they had a huge, whatever it was, auditorium, convention center or something, and they put a room divider down the middle, and there was another thing going on over here. And then our thing, and we're having dinner, and blah, 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 blah. And now it was time for the speaker, and the gal was Ed Chandler's wife, Sue. She introduced me and said, here's Sandy. I got up and I said, hi, everybody. My name's Sandy. I'm an alcoholic. At that point, the band on the other side started playing so loud, we couldn't hold the meeting. You couldn't hear a thing over the PA system. And they went over and they said, hey, we can't hear. Well, too bad. We rented this thing with the band. We're going to play all night, real loud. And somebody in the audience was in the theater business or something and had a key to an empty theater about four blocks away. And we all walked down the street, went in there, and had the meeting. And so that was the most unusual thing that ever happened when I was speaking. Okay, we're at the end of time. Sorry, John. Now, let's not have any applause. Let's not have anything. Let's just sort of reflect inside of ourselves and understand that we're going to get a lot of joy out of this period of silence and think about God, and we'll begin the silence now.